This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In this portion of the program, we're going to talk with Richard Longworth. He is the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalization. Longworth is a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and a former senior foreign correspondent with the Chicago Tribune. Richard Longworth grew up in a small town in central Iowa, Boone, Iowa. He's seen big changes come to his hometown beginning about a decade or so ago when we all began to hear those words, downsizing and outsourcing. Longworth says, quoting here, "How we earn our living determines how we live and who we are. This is true for people and it's true for towns, regions, and countries. The Midwest," he says, "does two things for a living, farming and heavy industry, and globalization has turned both upside down. In many ways," he continues, "Boone and the Midwest look as they always have, but their character has changed totally." In this portion of the program, we'll ask how global market forces are affecting our cities and small towns. We'll take a look at where we're headed in this new century. Listeners, I invite your thoughts, your questions, and comments about globalization for our guest, Richard Longworth. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Caught in the Middle, our guest Richard Longworth is the author of Global Squeeze, one of the first books on globalization. He is co-author of the book Global Chicago, published by the University of Illinois Press. Twice a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, he has also taught at Northwestern and Columbia and is a mentor at the Harris School at the University of Chicago. While a reporter for the Trib and for United Press International, he reported from 75 countries. Richard Longworth's new book, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism is published by Bloomsbury, and I think earlier I misspoke the title, the subtitle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Longworth, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, it's grand to be here. Thank you.
We use this word globalization a great deal. Perhaps here at the outset it would be useful to take a look at how it works. How does it work?
Well, don't worry about getting the name globalism or globalization mixed up. Actually got quite a good review on the book in the weekend Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah,
was
they
a
got
nice
the title
read.
Wrong, too. So
did they really?
They said in the age of globalization. I had it
oh
there
my.
In the age of globalism, and I used the word for a reason. I think this may be important.
Okay.
Globalization is the economic process. If you wanted to Google on globalization, you'd come up with thousands of different definitions. Everybody's got a different one. To keep it simple and to put it in the Midwestern context, globalization is pretty much the economic process that puts us, and that's factory workers, college graduates, farmers, everybody, in competition with everybody else around the world. We're not working in local economies, national economies. We're in a global economy, and we're simply competing with the rest of the world. That's globalization. And I use the word globalism because I didn't want this just to be about the economics of it. As you mentioned, how we earn our living determines everything else, and that's what a lot of the book is about the impact on our way of life, on small towns, on manufacturing cities, on bigger cities, on education, on this whole process of immigration. This is all tied in to this process of globalization or globalism, if you will. And, you know, out here in the Midwest, generally in the United States, we're the product of the industrial era. And that era is gone. It made us what we are. It changed everything. That era is gone, and we're in the global era now, and that's going to change everything, too, and that's globalism.
Yeah. Now, when and how did this begin, and what gave it its legs?
Well, you might say I've been writing it all my life. As you mentioned, I grew up in central Iowa, and I think if you grow up in a small town in central Iowa, your boyhood ambition is to get out of central Iowa. which is what I did at the first opportunity with so much momentum that I was about halfway across Siberia before I slowed up and started to work my way back. And I was a foreign correspondent for a number of years, specializing in international economics, which has kind of morphed into globalization now, and did a lot of work on how the economies and international economies can change the way people live and the way they regard each other. Back here in Chicago, with the Tribune and then later with the Council on Global Affairs, we began to look at how globalization is changing Chicago. The idea being that you really don't understand your own town these days unless you understand how it fits into the world. And we looked at Chicago, and we saw that it's not your daddy's old toddling town anymore. It's not the city of the big shoulders. It's not this industrial behemoth. That's gone. The industry went. But things were going on here, and what was going on was globalization. The Chicago had changed almost without us realizing it, from an industrial city to a global city. And that changed everything. We did this book called Global Chicago, which got into all these changes. That had some success. What we also tried to do and had some success at doing is getting Chicagoans to think of themselves as living in a global city, not this sort of isolated heartland flyover city in the middle of the continent, but something that's really tied into the rest of the world. And Chicagoans do now talk about their city as a global city. Then I got to thinking, since I come from central Iowa, I come from a small town area, how's globalization changing my old turf, and by extension, the Midwest, from Ohio through Iowa to the Mississippi, to the Missouri River? What's going on outside Chicago? So I simply got in the car, spent about 11,000 miles driving around the Midwest, talking to everybody I could, just to have a look at what was happening, and the book grew out of that.
Yeah. You spent, among the communities you spent some time in is Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
Interesting place.
Very interesting place. Dayton has a pretty good claim to have invented the 20th century. They have more patents per capita there than any place else. The Wright brothers, of course, came from there, but they invented the cash register, they invented the barcode, the stepladder, parking meter, the food that astronauts eat in space. Mostly, the big thing they invented was invented by a guy named Charles Kettering, who invented the ignition, automatic ignition for automobiles. And from that, he built the Dayton Electronic Laboratories Company, which was shortened to Delco, and is now Delphi.
Mm-hmm.
And Delphi has always been a really big deal in Dayton, which is kind of the quintessential old Midwestern auto alley factory town. They got five Delphi factories in Dayton, and four of them are about to close. Delphi, as we know, declared bankruptcy, or rather its American branch did, its overseas branch didn't. The idea was to get rid of factories, to get rid of employees in this country. And in Dayton, this gets personal. Delphi used to employ 30,000 people there in the Dayton region. When I was there a year or so ago, it's down to 6,000. Now, pretty quick, it's going to be down to a few hundred. And Dayton, which has lived and thrived on all this innovation, and especially on Delco for the past 100 years, is really wondering what it's going to do for an encore. Dayton is typical of these small manufacturing towns, the big ones we hear about, like Detroit and Cleveland. The smaller ones, Muncie, Indiana, Ottumwa, Iowa, Galesburg, Illinois, of course, Decatur, Danville, Anderson, all these places, that thrived for the last century on manufacturing, on heavy manufacturing, a lot of it auto-related, and that's gone. And they really, most of these places are wondering, literally, whether they're going to survive.
Yeah. Well, how is Dayton thinking about its problem and how it might remake itself?
In two different ways. One way, it's really trying to hold on to what it's got. And I think that's the wrong way. Going around the Midwest, places that seem to be recovering are places, maybe like Chicago, that really hit bottom 20 or 30 years ago and realized that if they were going to survive, they're going to have to reinvent themselves. holding on to the past doesn't work because it takes away time and energy and money that you need to build the future. And there's still a lot in Dayton that wants to hold on to the past. But there also are people there who are looking to the future. And one way of doing that is saying, the past is gone, how can we use it? In other words, how can we build on the past? Let me give a couple of examples. There's quite a little bioscience industry going in Peoria, Illinois. Well, Peoria used to be a big whiskey city. And as somebody there told me, they know fermentation in Peoria. So they are good at that sort of thing. They're good at plant and animal science, and they're working on that. Chicago, we don't have the stockyards anymore, but we still have the LaSalle Street markets. They don't trade pork bellies anymore, but they know trading. And now they trade international derivatives and make quite an industry off of it. In Dayton, they're looking at nanotechnology. Now, this is the manipulation of subatomic particles to do things, make new materials, that sort of thing. Okay, Dayton, what it's done for a living is make things. They know materials. They're looking to see if they can use this knowledge, this tradition and history and legacy of materials to tap into this new 21st century industry and make something out of it. I got to say, it's a gleam in their eye. Nobody knows whether this is going to work. If it does work, nobody knows how many jobs are there, how many of these 30,000 jobs that Delphi provided will nanotech pick up. How will this spin off? It's early days, and we really don't know.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Richard Longworth, author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now on listener on line one. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Champaign.
Okay, go ahead.
Just a correction, I think. The parking meter was invented by at Oklahoma State University. I've seen the original one. They've got it on display in the student union there.
Well, let me have a look there. If you're right, we can do a correction right here on the air.
In the meantime, let me give the phone numbers again.
Well, now the people in Dayton do claim to have invented the parking meter, the movie projector, the parachute, the gas mask, and even the pop-top can.
Wow.
And they do lay claim to the parking meter.
Okay,
so,
which company is this again?
Pardon?
Which company is this?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. But
this is just what I was told by the people in Dayton.
In Dayton.
And I took their word for it, and...
Okay.
Happy to check it out. The company I was talking about was Delphi, which was auto parts.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure they had nothing to do with
the parking meter. Okay, let's take another call.
But your correction is appreciated, and I'll check it out.
Okay, listener on the toll-free line, line four, where are you calling from this afternoon?
Belgium.
Hi.
Belgium, Miss Quinn. I'd like to, you mentioned Danville, and I'm
yeah.
very close to
right.
Danville. And I'd like to... Notice a thing that these towns you're talking about that have made some recoveries are towns that were fairly large already, maybe 100,000 or so. Danville is kind of unique in the aspect that it was a very small town that had very large industrial base in it. General Motors, General Electric, Hyster Corporation, GE, a lot of big plants that left during the 70s and 80s and 90s. And it took a town that was from about 50,000. Now it's down to about 30,000.
Yeah.
Well, at 30,000, they're too small to make any kind of major recovery because we no longer have any tax base. And it's really a sad story that's going on in Danville. It's a beautiful little town that is just slowly but surely sinking into the sunset.
You are describing so many towns around the Midwest, and you're absolutely right, and it's a very vivid description. We know that the global era, globalization, the knowledge economy, really is kind of an urban thing. It's a metro thing. It's a process that gathers people in cities, like the great global cities, New York, London, Shanghai, places like Chicago, and to a lesser degree, old places like Indianapolis or Minneapolis. The industrial era needed a lot of these small manufacturing towns like Danville. And you find this industry, this heavy industry, really pretty evenly scattered out across the Midwestern countryside, all the way from Ohio to Iowa. And, of course, Danville's right in the path of that. The question is, does this new economy need towns like Danville? Is there an economic reason there? They're going to have to invent something. And some towns... Size may not have an awful lot to do with it. Cleveland is big. Detroit is big. Both are really suffering. I was up in a little town up in north of Grand Rapids called Greenville, Michigan. And they made refrigerators there. They made a lot else. They had about three or four big manufacturing plants in a town of about only 15,000. But Electrolux was their big thing, and Electrolux closed down. And the general feeling was, turn out the lights, that's the end of Greenville. A factory that makes solar panels phoned up Greenville pretty much out of the blue and said, we'd like to set up factories there. We'd like to set up six solar panel factories, each employing 200 people. Now, that's 1,200 jobs. The Electrolux plant that closed employed about 3,400. So this 1,200 isn't going to make up for the 3,400 is lost, but it probably will save the town. So you find some towns that do have some success. There's something else to be said about this, and this isn't something that will make the people in Danville feel any better. Will those 1,200 jobs go to any of the people who worked at Electrolux? Probably not. It's an entirely different set of skills. This new economy, like this solar panel plant, is probably going to need people with a couple years of college under their belt, good community college. Electrolux didn't. You may have a lost generation, something like we saw when the steel mills went under in Chicago back in the 80s, where a whole generation of steel workers simply lost their place in the world. It's not only an economic problem, it's a human tragedy.
If I might point out one other thing here that seems to be really a detriment to our community and quite possibly many in Illinois, we have some very strenuous laws referring to workers' comp and things like that that were very good with the industrial aspect that we used to be, but it's very detrimental to try to bring new work in because of the complications with some of the workman comp laws and stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of those laws are being weakened. We know that unions are being weakened. Some places, auto plants around Ann Arbor, Michigan, in Peoria, unions like the UAW are cooperating with companies to bring in new industries. Jobs are growing, but a lot of the old union protection, the jurisdictional laws, some of the worker comp laws, those are being lost, and so workers have less protection, less prospect of a really prosperous future than they did. They still have their jobs, and that's about all you can say.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Richard Longworth, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. One of the things that you write about in the book, Caught in the Middle, is that it's something I think our last caller alluded to, is that we might see ourselves as victims of our own success. Maybe you would talk with us about John Austin and what he sees.
Well, he is writing about that as something that you see going across the Midwest. John Austin is based at Ann Arbor. He's done quite a lot of work with the Brookings Foundation. He is now working with us here at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on this. His research has focused on the Great Lakes states, which is slightly different, takes in upstate New York and a couple of the Canadian provinces, whereas my geographical area extends a bit more to the west. But basically, we're talking about the same thing and talking about the same phenomenon. And what you're referring to here is the fact that, you know, 100 years ago, the Midwest was the Silicon Valley of the United States. It's hard for us to imagine that now. But all these good ideas that we had, the Charles Kettering type people, Timken, Goodrich, Olds, Ford, all these backyard tinkerers and guys in garages with good ideas, they were entrepreneurs, they were innovators, they were real rollers of the dice, they were gamblers. They bet all on a good idea, and it paid off. And it paid off for this region, too. And we've been living on it ever since. These are the people who built the big companies, the big manufacturing operations, and through thick and thin for, you know, most of the last century, we have been living off this. Our workers have been living off of it. There always was a job in the mill or the plant. The unions have been living off of it. The companies themselves, having had a good idea, didn't need to expand, didn't need to innovate. Towns always had a ready source of taxes, and have been living off these big plants. Even executives and business people, our business schools at the Big Ten universities have been training generations of business people on how to run these big factories, not how to create new ones. In short, having had one good idea, the Midwest has been living on it ever since, and the upshot is we've forgotten how to have good ideas. We've lost that knack of innovation. We've lost that inclination to roll the dice, the sort of thing that you see in California, especially, you see on the coast. People are willing to risk and be entrepreneurs and come up with a good idea and really take a chance. That's not us. We've gotten very stable and safe in our big industrial economy, and now that's gone. The industrial age isn't over, but it's over in this part of the world. It's moved somewhere else, and we have now to innovate. And I'm afraid we've forgotten how. You know, the big question is, how do we get that back?
Yeah. Well, we are. I guess we're going to have to experiment, aren't we?
We really are. We're going. It's going to take time. We have to have new ways of thinking. Our universities. You're in a big university town there. Good ideas come out of Champaign-Urbana. The best idea was something, of course, was called Mosaic, which the guy who invented it couldn't find any local financing, anybody to back him. So he picked up Mosaic, took it to California, changed the name to Netscape, and the rest is history. He invented pretty much much of what's going on now. Mm. How do we reward our ideas? How do we back our good ideas? How do we take the brain power that you have at the University of Illinois and all the other big Midwestern universities and harness it to the new age, so we not only come up with good ideas, but we use these ideas, as the entrepreneurs of 100 years ago did, to create a new economy and to support a new civilization.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of other listeners who would like to talk with you. First, we go to the toll-free line. Line 4, where are you calling from this afternoon?
I'm on the road in Elburn, Illinois.
Okay.
You know what? You're right down my alley. I'm a small business, and actually I'm probably going to go belly up because of the way the because I'm in the service industry. And I kind of you brought up a whole bunch of reasons why this economy is going down the toilet the way America is. One reason being, in the 90s, we grew so fast. Economy grew so fast in the 90s, you know, that I think all these people made so much money off of things, the cost of, or the, you know, I said the price of everything went through the roof. I mean, the value, like a house, a car, you know. I remember here 20 years ago, 20, 30 years ago, things weren't, it was growing at a slower rate. Now it's gotten so overpriced, and I think what's happening as we're seeing that right now, I think the houses are overpriced, I think cars are overpriced, and I think it hit kind of a top. And hopefully it'll go back down, because it's just ridiculous how much you spend on things anymore. The other thing is, too, you're right. You know, we used to be a country full of inventors. Well, right now, where are all the inventors? They're in India. They're in other countries in the world that want to be better than us, or they all used to want to come over here to learn American trade and to learn how to work as an American. Now it's like reverting. Maybe I think we'll end up in China or someplace, because Americans don't care. There is no, I really do. I think as a small business owner, I can't make headway. I'm taxed to death. Every time I turn around, they want to take more money from me. And I'm small, and I think it's unfair.
Yeah. Well, let's let our guest, Richard Longworth, come in and offer his thoughts.
Well, it's not this. I mean, there are areas in this country. We are, as I mentioned at the start, what we are is in competition with the whole world. We didn't used to be. We used to be in competition maybe with Japan and with Europe. But now we're in competition with the whole world, so we do have to think about all this innovation and drive that's coming out of places like China and India. But let's remember there are areas in this country that are doing quite well. California is one. The Northwest, around Seattle, a real hotbed of innovation. If somebody goes belly up there, tomorrow they're back in business doing something else. What we ought to be able to do in this part of the world is bioscience. I mean, that's plant and animal science. And if there's anything we got around here, it's plants and animals. We ought to be able to spin off that and create a bioscience industry. And as a matter of fact, we're trying to do it. But we're already behind. The big running is being done in California and being done on the East Coast. You're right also that things are moving fast, but let me mention something else that's moving, apart from prices going up and that sort of thing. While we were napping, the whole world changed. I think it's important to remember just how new this globalization stuff is. China has been part of the global economy for maybe 20 years, India for about 10 years. Most of the big technological changes, the communication satellites, the internet, Netscape, fiber optic cables, that sort of thing. Almost all of this has happened in the lifetime of today's college freshmen. We are really at the beginning of a new era, and it's moving so fast, and we haven't been very nimble here. We haven't moved fast enough. And the good news is that the global age is really new. The bad news is that the Midwest is already behind.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we've got a number of other folks who are waiting to talk with us. Next, we go to a listener on line two. Hi.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Hi.
Hi.
I just turned your show on. I'd love these afternoon. This station is one of the greatest stations I've ever listened to on the radio. I mean, period. Where do I start? The knowledge of the United States people has always been at the forefront. Dang it. I lost a shuttle this morning. Dang it. We are the leaders. We should act like the leaders. Dang it. You know, I don't know. I'm stymied by people like you, the guest, and I turn it on late. I don't know who you are, but I disagree with you saying that we aren't the leaders. We are the leaders. I didn't get my degree, but dang it, I know something about the space program, and I know something about physics. Dang it. That's all I got to say. I'm stymied by people that don't give American people the credit.
Well, I think maybe because you tuned in a little late, maybe you have a kind of a different take on where we are in the discussion and where our guest is coming from. Our guest's name is Richard Longworth. He's the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. And I think Mr. Longworth would say we've got a lot of strengths, and what we need to do is to draw on them. Our guest is a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and a former correspondent with the Chicago Trib.
Celeste, I agree with the caller on one thing wholeheartedly?
Sure. Yes.
When you drive around the Midwest, that I did a lot of in the past year or so, you are never really, and you listen to the radio in the car, mm-hmm. You're never out of range of the voice of Rush Limbaugh. And you're never out of range of the sound of a really good NPR station, most of them coming from universities. NPR is, I really think, locked in the battle for the hearts and minds of American people and certainly Midwesterners. And your station is an example, but there is so much good stuff coming out of NPR available to everybody in the Midwest, and I salute you.
Well, thank you for that. Next, we talk with a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
Hi.
I'll make two comments, if I may.
Sure.
These would be things that, if followed through creatively, could turn around not just the Midwest, but maybe the whole U.S. economy. And the first one I'll say is solving the gasoline/oil/transportation costs, and that is to come up with some hybrid vehicle that completely gets us off dependence on oil. And that could create jobs creating these vehicles, whether it's multitudes of companies. But I know one of the presidential candidates, I don't remember which one, in one of the early debates said we ought to give a billion-dollar prize to somebody that can come up with a vehicle that does not need oil or gas to operate. And whether it's a solar hybrid or a hydrogen hybrid or something, to me, that's one of the basic keys to getting this economy back up and going. The second one would be, I mean, it's sarcastic, but 99.44% of the U.S. Congress, and I'll even throw in the White House, has to be thrown out and replaced with possibly independent party, third party, smart people that can solve our issues rather than using money as the deciding factor in everything that they do. So that's my comments.
Okay.
But what I would say to that is, of course, on hybrid vehicles and doing something about the gas problem and the import of energy that we seem to be addicted to, you're absolutely right. Of course, we do. Hybrid vehicles, other sorts of vehicles, hydrogen-powered vehicles, these are the key to the future. Again, I was talking about Dayton trying to see a new nanotech future because they know something about materials. Well, we know something in the Midwest about cars. We've made them all these years. We don't make as many cars as we used to, and we're going to probably be making fewer in the future. But we are a source of auto knowledge, and there are places here for research, for design, for some specialty manufacturing, engine manufacturing, things like that, that could be a big money turner, a big job creator for the Midwest, because if there's anything we know out here, it's transport. As far as politics, I think, as Winston Churchill said, democracy is certainly the worst form of government, except for all the others have been tried. We are stuck with it, and we will be relying on it. One thing that I suggest in the book is that so much of what's going on now, especially in globalization, has moved beyond politics and moved beyond the traditional forms of government. I talk mostly about state governments and how we're locked within state lines here in the Midwest that were drawn 200 years ago. Didn't make an awful lot of sense then, make even less sense now, but they really keep us from cooperating as a region. We need, the federal system is not about to be repealed. The states are going to be there, but is there ways of other people taking the leadership, cities, universities, business groups, citizens groups, operating across state lines to bring this region together so it can act as a region instead of relying always on state governments. Once we do that, once we have this clout as a region, we can go to Washington with some firm agenda and with some power to get what this region really needs.
Is there a model to look toward that would give us some hints on how to accomplish this?
There are several going around the world. As globalization is undermining the ability of national governments to control their own economies. We don't have national economies anymore. We're into a global economy, and most governments, including our own, simply can't regulate and control and run and energize a national economy the way it used to. The Europeans know this. So they not only have the European Union, but you have a lot of regions within Europe that have come together, some across national lines, to work together. You have other areas, the Pearl River Basin area in China, regions that are working together. In this country, Probably the region that's doing the most is the South. Now, the South has a strong Southern consciousness. We don't have a Midwestern consciousness. The Southern consciousness is built on geography, but it's also built on their very difficult and tragic history, the memories of the Civil War, but they do seem to think like Southerners. And they have put together something called the Southern Growth Policy Board. It's the only sort of regional think tank that I know of in this country. And they do a lot in promoting regional economic development and promoting regional environmental protection projects and promoting regional cooperation in energy or education or other fields across state lines. I'd very much like to see something like that get started here in the Midwest.
Let's take another call. Listener on line four. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Bloomington, Indiana.
Okay.
I want to revisit the comment you made on biosciences, and I think you're absolutely correct. And because the bioscience aspect really addresses at least two things that I'm now familiar with, a source of petroleum, in this case could be biodiesel, and secondly, a means of promoting nutrient density foods that heretofore, I don't really agree that we have available in grocery stores and in restaurants. And in fact, the type of agriculture that I'm suggesting is one that minimizes the use of petroleum via the Haber process to make ammonium nitrate, but instead concentrates on soil microbiology and soil biochemistry that really bumps up the microorganisms that are really running the show as far as soil formation and soil fertility. But the end point of the whole discussion, at least as far as the plant operation, is human health. And we spend an extraordinary amount of money in our country, and it's not really limited to us, to do a bandage approach to what our dietary choices are in terms of how sickly we are. And just by doing a different type of bioscience that delightfully addresses this.
Now, tell me, you're at the University of Indiana?
I'm a student at Indiana University.
Okay, is there research in these areas going on down there in Bloomington?
I have to unfortunately say no.
Okay, because there is research in all this going on around the Midwest, but it's fragmented again quite often because of state lines. Now, getting universities, for instance, to work together is murder. As you know, even getting Indiana U and Purdue within the state of Indiana to work together is like pulling teeth. But the fact is that you have research on a lot of this going on at Purdue, at the University of Illinois, up in Minnesota, Washington University, down in St. Louis, Iowa State. There is a lot of this going on around the Midwest, but it is fragmented. We are much less than the sum of our parts because none of these universities or these researchers, they very seldom work together on this. Largely, they are big state universities like the University of Illinois or the University of Indiana. They are beholden to their states, and they don't cooperate on state lines like this. If some sort of Midwestern bioscience industry could be framed like you have in New England or like you have in California, then we might be able to do something in the health area, go beyond the universities, bring in, the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or other big health operations like that. We've got the brain power in this area to do all this if we would just put it together.
Well, I'll give you a good example. I decided a few years ago that I was tired of hearing myself bellyache about this problem, and I realized that the only way I was going to make progress is by reentering the university, studying chemistry, organic, and now biochemistry. Along the line, I started reading peer-reviewed journaled articles in the chemistry library, and I started finding that there are connections of researchers not limited to this country that are actually grappling with it. Somewhere along the line, I came across a company by the name of Martek Biosciences, headquartered in Maryland. And what they've done, and I just spoke with their chief researcher last week, they have selected two strains of microalgae, and the similar component of algae are ones that phytoplankton in the...
You know, I think we're probably getting it over the head, most
yeah.
of our listeners, including me.
Okay, well, the whole thing about microalgae is they have fatty acids, and you can take fatty acids and you can make omega-3 fatty acids that are required for our nutrition. You can get the EPA
but if,
and DHA.
If I may say so, the point here I think we need to make right here is, yes, there is an awful lot of cooperation going on with scientists in other countries, in Europe and China and places like that. How about some cooperation between Midwestern states? We do have a basis for this industry here. Why can't we work together on this and other processes?
What's standing in the way?
State lines. The state universities are answerable to their legislatures. The legislatures and the governor are answerable to the voters. They wouldn't dream of cooperating with somebody across the state line. I was astonished going around researching this book, talking with people in individual states to find out how little knowledge there is of what's going on in the rest of the Midwest. I could talk to somebody in Indiana who knew everything there was to know about Indiana, who didn't have the foggiest idea of what was happening in Illinois or Ohio or Michigan, just right next door. It doesn't pay anybody here to cooperate across state lines. It doesn't pay a university like Indiana University, to cooperate with Purdue or with the University of Illinois because they're competing every day. Well, we're not competing with the states next door anymore. We're competing with China, and we're competing with Europe, and we're competing with the rest of the world. And it's time we started merging our strengths into a regional economy so we can compete from a position of strength.
Have you followed the FutureGen story at all?
Beg pardon?
Have you followed the FutureGen story?
I have not. Tell me about it.
Well, this is a... I'm trying to Google it now because off the top of my head, I'm afraid I will make some errors here. But this was a cooperative venture on the part of a number of communities and actually states coming together to try to get this thing going in Mattoon, Illinois.
I know what you're talking about. I'm doing anything on it too. The one that just got shot down by the federal government.
Right.
Yes.
And a number of states came together in alliance and a number of communities came together, and they decided that Mattoon would be the place to put this.
And there was a lot of excitement about this.
This coal-fueled near-zero emissions power plant.
There was a lot of excitement about this and a lot of disappointment when this happened. What does this tell us about reliance on the federal government to do this? Would have been possible to do this more as a regional project where the money have been there? Could we have done this? I'm not sure that anybody even asked these questions before they went into it.
Yeah. One last question. There is a chapter in the book about farming, mega farmers, and this station has a strong commitment to agricultural programming, and we're about to make that transition here. We're going to have settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade here in just a second. But to sum up, to wrap up here, you want to give us your thoughts on how our farmers are faring and what lies ahead for them?
Our farmers are faring fine, those that are still in business. This is a process, like so much is going on in industry and elsewhere, that wasn't started by globalization by any means. This is the trend towards consolidation of farms, ever fewer farmers, bigger farms. The crisis, as that's not too strong a word, in the small farm towns, as the family farmers move out or the number of family farmers shrink, these towns are literally dying. I don't see much change there. I mean, we can blame a lot of this on federal farm policy, and that certainly has to carry part of the blame for this. But basically, this is a globalization process. When farmers, too, are in cooperation, and in competition with farmers in Brazil or in France or the Ukraine for markets in India or China, it is a big global market. It is dominated by the big global agribusiness corporations, the Monsantos, ADM, Cargill, operations like that, who have always dominated the farm industry. These are corporations that will make contracts with farmers. They demand on-time delivery. They demand quantity control and quality control. They demand efficiency. Great regularity. In other words, they demand the sort of things that can only be delivered by big, efficient, highly mechanized farmers. And this is driving the process of farm consolidation to ever, ever bigger farms. And I don't think there is anything that is going to change that. Farming itself will continue to be a profitable industry, but for fewer and fewer farms. There is, of course, a growing number of small farmers who are feeding farmers markets or specialty markets. But they still will be a fringe to this overall process of consolidation and globalization of Midwestern agriculture.
Mm, there we've got to leave it. Richard Longworth, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Yes, thank you.
Richard Longworth is author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. The book is published by Bloomsbury. And now let's turn things over to Todd Gleason, who has settlement prices from Kansas City, Minneapolis, and Chicago. Todd?
Thank you very much, Celeste. Taking a look at the numbers as they settled on this Tuesday afternoon in Chicago. The nearby wheat, a dollar higher today. $12.98 the high, the low at $11.46. They finished $12.40, up a dollar even. May futures, $12.23 the high, the low at $11.47¾. The settlement price at $12.23, up 60. And July, $11.81¾ the high. A low at $11.01, settlement price up 60 cents at $11.81¾. September contract in the wheat pit, $11.98½ for the soft red high. Low at $11.12¾, settlement price for $11.90, up 51½ cents. In December futures in Chicago at the soft red winter wheat, $12. The top, the bottom at $11.19. A settlement price just three off the top at $11.97. They gained 57 cents. Spring wheat nearby Chicago at 17, or nearby Minneapolis, gained a dollar as well at $17 even. And the March hard red winter wheat at $12.50 in Kansas City, up 60 cents. Corn futures now, nearby March contract, $5.72 the high, the low at $49¾. Settlement price at $5.64, up 8½ cents. May futures, $5.79½ the high, the low at $58. Settlement price up 6¾ at $5.72½. And July futures in the corn pit, $5.93 the high, the low at $70¼. Settlement price at $5.84½, up 6¼ for the day. September futures, $5.90¾ the high, the low at $73¼. A settlement price at $5.86½, up 7½. In December contract in the corn pit, this is your new crop month, $5.90¾ the high, the low at $5.72¼. New crop corn, up 6½ cents at $5.85½. The March futures, $5.98 the high, the low at $5.68¼, and a settlement price at $5.93, up 6¼. March oat futures up 13 cents at $3.95. The May at $4.02½, up 11¾ for the day. Soy complex now. March beans, $14.18 the high, the low at $13.75. Settlement price at $13.92½, up 4½ cents. May futures $14.40¼ for the high, the low at $13.90. May beans settled, $14.07¾, up 1¼. July futures, $14.54, the high, the low at $14.04½. Settlement price at $14.23½, up 3. In August contract, unchanged at $14.09. The high at $14.40, the low at $13.95½. September contract, $13.88½, the high, the low at $13.47. Settlement price at $13.67½, up 12 cents. November contract, your new crop soybeans settled at $13.15¼. Their high today at $13.35, the low at $12.87¼. Settlement price at $13.15¼. up 15.25 cents. And January futures were up 16 today, the high at 13.44 3/4, the low at 13.07. Settlement price at $13.24, 16 higher for the January soybeans. March bean meal futures 3.60, the high, the low at 3.47. Settlement price at 3.47, down 6.20. And the May bean meal at 3.68, top, bottom at 3.50. Settlement price at 3.50.80, down 7.50 on the afternoon. March bean oil futures 62.60, up 140, with a top at 62.70, low at 62.08. And the May bean oil 63.73, the high, the low at 61 cents, 0.91. And a settlement price at 63.19, up a penny, and 0.05 for the afternoon. I'll be back at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. That's 9 minutes away now. During the closing market report, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities, and then we'll talk with Steve Platt of Archer Financial Services in Chicago about the energy markets. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Let's turn our attention now to what happened today at the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago with the livestock contracts. March feeder cattle, $100.60, the high, the low $99.45, the settlement $99.75, that down 45. April, $103.70, the high $102.25, the low $102.35, the settlement, that down 77.5. May, $106.80, the high $105.30, the low $105.77.5, the settlement, that down 37.5. August, $110.70, the high $109.40, the low $109.70, the settlement, that down 65. April live cattle, $90.55, the high $89.85, the low $89.90, the settlement, that up 15. June, $92.22.5, the high $91.62.5, the low, the settlement $91.70, that up 20. August, $96.45, the high $95.95, the low, the settlement $96.15, that up 20. October, $101.75, the high $101.25, the low, the settlement $101.57.5, that up 40. April lean hogs, $58.90, the high $57.70, the low $58.30, the settlement, that up 57.5. May, $68.85, the high $68 even, the low $68.70, the settlement, that up 30. June, $74.90, the high $73.85, the low $74.75, the settlement, that up 85. And July lean hogs, $78.75, the high $77.75, the low, the settlement $78.57.5, that up 60. And March pork belly, $79.70, the high $77 even, the low $79.70, the settlement, that up 120. The Dow is currently up 337 points at 12,077. The NASDAQ up 65 at 22,235. And the S&P 500 up 37 at 13,09. Oil up 90 to $108.80 a barrel. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
This is station manager Jay Pierce. During our Spring Power Hour on April 3rd, we'll challenge listeners to match, in 1 hour, the entire amount of money in our member match fund that we raise between now and then. Please contribute today. Mail your check or give online at willpledge.org.
Coming up, we'll have news from National Public Radio. Then Todd Gleason will be in with the closing market report. Let's take a look at Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northern Illinois and in eastern Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy, elsewhere mostly sunny. Highs ranging from 40 in northeastern Indiana to 57 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy, lows ranging from 25 in northwestern Illinois to 40 in southern Illinois. And the outlook for tomorrow, in northern Illinois, becoming mostly cloudy, elsewhere partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from 45 in far northwestern Illinois to 68 in southern Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. News is next.